This week has been a hard week for me. On the one hand, my uncle passed away, and I've been dealing with that, and it's been difficult to sort of deal with. On the other hand, there's been a lot of media attention about the situation happening in Ferguson, Missouri. The most difficult part about what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri is that white people are discussing this like it's an abnormality, as if this is not how the police operate. On the other hand, I do feel vindicated by having so many white people say, oh wow, this is really messed up. And then further complicating that vindication, the fact that it comes from white approval, makes me angrier than anything else in the situation. There was a time, really the last time that I followed the news, cable news and New York Times and all that very closely, was when I lived with my uncle. And we used to sit and talk about all the news, and we used to discuss the racial implications of every news story. And I miss having my uncle here to discuss things, and I also miss just talking about the black side of every news story. It was something that me and my uncle used to argue about because we had very different views about the black experience and what it meant, and whether there was a black side to everything. But like a lot of things me and my uncle used to argue about, I realized that he was right, that we maybe were talking a different language, but he was right about how he viewed the world, and that while maybe every facet doesn't have a black side necessarily, the ways in which black people experience political life in America is so different and sometimes diametrically opposed to the way that white people experience political and social events in this country, that our race plays a part in everything that we do. In every news story, there's a racial angle just because of how we experience it. As the stock market goes up and down, and black people have a different relationship to the market, given the amount of wealth we have, the amount of income we have, and how we tend to use it, it's going to affect us differently. So it should be no surprise to me that stories of a racial riot or racial demonstrations in a Midwest town would have far-flung racial implications. However, I was not prepared for how angry the differences would be, and I was not prepared for how upsetting it would be to hear and see and read white people processing what's happening in Ferguson, like they're processing police brutality for the first time, when it is something that I have really thought about my whole life, and it's something that I constantly think about, and especially in the activist community, in which getting arrested and dealing with police is viewed in this really weird way of, you know, you get good press if you're arrested, which is a distinctly white idea, I think, based on how the press views white people who get arrested versus black people who get arrested. I would even argue white criminals who get arrested are generally viewed better than black activists who get arrested, and also are less likely to be charged with resisting arrest. So these are all the thoughts that I've been thinking of, and as I kind of take some time to deal with the death of my uncle, I've been dealing with Ferguson and dealing with this is something that I wish I could talk to him about, that I wish I could hear, because we used to spend hours talking about why black people are not rioting and why black people are not protesting on the streets. And he had a lot of things to say about that, and I think so it's hard for me to process this all at once, and so I thought I would put this podcast together and try and work through my emotions that way.
When you wonder what your role is in this country and what your future is in it, how precisely you're going to reconcile yourself to your situation here, and how you're going to communicate to the vast, heedless, unthinking, cruel white majority that you are here. And to be here means that you can't be anywhere else. I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. These people have deluded themselves for so long, they really don't think I'm human. I have basis on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters. It's a terrible indictment. I mean every word I say. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves? It doesn't matter any longer what you do to me. You can put me in jail. You can kill me. But by the time I'm 17, you've done everything that you could do to me. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves?
And it wasn't too long before three white men came to my cell. I could hear the sounds of licks and horrible screams. And I could hear somebody say, "Can you say yes, sir, nigga?" She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So I said, she said, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her I don't know how long. And after a while, she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on those people.
I got to the point that I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak.
Human beings are not by nature nonviolent. You can only survive so many beatings, so much humiliation, so much despair, so many broken promises, before something gives.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. Policeman is there to preserve disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. 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 The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
The line is advancing onto the crowd. Here come the police. The line is standing. The crowd is peacefully standing with their hands in the air, yelling, "We are peaceful, hands up, don't shoot." Here comes the St. Louis County Police Department, continuing to advance their line. We have now pulled back a city block and a half. There it goes there, now firing onto the crowd. Out! Shit! They're firing rubber bullets.
Let us sit back!
Fucking stop doing something!
That's right! Let him look out! Hey, I got them same Roman candles! Who give a fuck?
The world
is now fired onto the crowd for a second time. Violence has erupted in the city of Ferguson. They are firing rubber bullets and smoke grenades. The air is thick.
I tell you, I've seen the lightning flash. I've heard the thunder roll. I've felt shin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul, but I heard the voice of Jesus and still to fight on.
There's not such a thing as a monolithic wall or, you know, some abstraction called the Negro problem. These Negro boys and girls who at 16 and 17 don't believe the country means anything that it says, don't feel they have any place in it on the basis of the performance of the entire country.
One thing has been the same. No presumption of innocence for young black men. No benefit of the doubt. Guilt, not determined by what they did or said, but presumed to be inherent in their very being. They need not wield a weapon to pose a threat, because if you are a young black man, you are threat enough.
I remember thinking of dropping watermelons. My cousin and I once got to drop a rotten watermelon on the same asphalt. It bounced lightly several times, busting a little more each time it hit the burning blackness of the ground. Dark red putrid juices oozed slowly from the melon like blood rushing from Rodney King's head. Strange fruit indeed.
Blood on the leaves.
childhood memory is a funny thing. Some moments that were actually minutes seem like hours. Some moments are actually several events that have, over time, coalesced into amalgamated scenes. Still, other memories of childhood are not yours, but family stories told so often that you feel like you've lived them. This is why childhood memories represent such a powerful truth. As the details fade, the vague emotions, quotes, and lessons begin to coat the lens through which we see the world. Childhood memories are the basis on which we create our subjective truth. When I was a kid, the LAPD beat a black man to death every week. Or at least, that's how I remembered the 90s. You can't call on him, Daddy, now. He's up in Atlanta, 175 miles away. You can't even call on Mama now. My mother's family lived in LA, and I visited often, which made each beating seem more relevant to me. They seemed like something I was supposed to keep track of, like the signs on the highway that tell you how many people died on the road so far this year. Yet the number of beatings seemed even more vital, like if the number of traffic deaths in a year informed your summer travel plans. When we went to LA, we always used to say we were going to California. Sometimes we'd take a sweaty van ride, the remnants of grape drink dried and gluing us to our seats, for what seemed like hours out to the valley where our cousins lived. I was always amazed that it was still LA County. In my mind, all of Southern California was LA County. CNN used to always ask a black correspondent if they thought the city was going to riot every time it happened. As a child, I thought there was always a chance black people would riot in LA, and every riot would be deconstructed by a Brian Williams voiceover played over helicopter footage of Koreatown in 1992.
East of the scene in... He's driving eastbound. I'm going right over the top of him, so I'm going to lose him now. But it's the first law enforcement activity I've seen out here.
They obviously have thought about this. They anticipated this, they meaning the LAPD. They obviously have plans to deal with it. And as we said before, they've allocated $1 million to overtime in case things like this happen. So they are obviously carrying out a pre-thought-out plan.
In the meantime, don't go near this area. South Central Los Angeles at Florence.
When Rodney King was assaulted, I was 4 years old. I don't think I have actual memories of the night, other than vague recollections of my mother calling to check on her family. Yet I distinctly remember a police beating in LA several years later that was being discussed on 60 Minutes over the backdrop of images from 1992 riots, interspersed with bloody images of Rodney King's swollen head. I was watching the news with my parents, as I often did after dinner. My parents got in an argument about what people should do when assaulted by the police. My mother said violence would not get us anywhere, while my father barely stopped before advocating beating the cops themselves. It was a moment of rare outburst and real conversation between my parents, who always tried to have any sort of disagreement, political or otherwise, in another room. My parents were very religious Baha'is who taught nonviolence to their children equally religiously. My mother preached it very well, as I think it came more naturally to her. For my father, who grew up in New York in the 50s and 60s, sometimes I could see in his outburst of anger that little boy who had grown and seen the riots in New York in the 60s.
And I could hear somebody say, "Can you say yes, sir, nigga?" She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So what I said, she said, "I don't know you well enough."
I studied my father's face in that moment, hoping to memorize it so I could duplicate it later like everything else my father did. My father's eyes were burning with anger and indignation, and tinged with the subtle hint of an emotion my young mind didn't register. I was old enough to know police brutality as something to be vigilant against, one of those potential calamities I'd face when I got older, like car accidents and illness. I knew it was something I needed to know how to handle. My mother told my father to be quiet and motioned over to me. When my father saw how I had been studying his face, trying to memorize the anger for later, I realized what that subtle emotion had been. His eyebrows arched in alarm and his face softened enough that I could recognize the fear in my father's eyes. Both my father and I were young enough for me to still think of him as being invincible, Superman-like, my hero. to recognizing my father's fear amplified my own.
Yes, sometimes I feel discouraged and feel my works in vain.
My father looked at me and said something he barely did back then. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. He then lectured to me for several minutes about how to speak to the police. I remember him saying, no matter what, it's always yes sir, yes ma'am. My father told me to show the police respect, especially when they didn't deserve it, in the same authoritative tone he told me to call my grandmother my dear, and it seemed equally archaic and southern to me. I resented the police in that moment for making my father afraid, for demanding his respect and mine. As 60 Minutes continued to show footage of swollen black heads bouncing off the concrete, my father continued the talk. My father's eyes were turning red at this point, and his lecturing turned almost to pleading. As I got older, I would realize that these moments were when my father was teaching me things he had learned the hard way. I can imagine now, though I couldn't then, my father being thrown against walls and having police pat him down, having police call him a nigger, telling him he wouldn't amount to nothing, questioning his very presence in his own city.
What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there is no difference in north and the south. There's just a difference in the way they, in a way, they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why.
This is when my father gave me perhaps his most memorable advice. When, not if, the police start beating you, your only goal is to survive. You don't get to say a word. You don't get to fight back. You don't get justice. You survive. Protect your head. That's what matters. The only reason you have to not protect your head is if you're protecting someone else's. In light of the Michael Brown execution, social media has been abuzz with hashtag I got the talk, where people of color talk about similar instances where older family members taught them how to not get beat down by the police. I found the framing of the talk to be interesting and also inaccurate. It assumes that there were only one. That there was only one talk I had with elder family members to teach me how to survive being black in America. There were dozens of ways I was taught to stay alive. There were dozens of people who taught me these lessons. Not just my parents, my uncles, my aunts, my grandfather. Me and my Uncle Buddy Boy used to sit in his room for hours discussing these kinds of things. We would talk about how
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must.